Good morning. This is Kim Mooney with my quarterly show on death and dying. Today, we're going to be talking about medical aid in dying in Colorado and nationally. I've done the show on MAID, I think, three times since the law passed, but we're at a really important and critical juncture, and we have some new resources, so I wanted to update you. And we also, this is a call to action in a couple of ways. So I'm going to introduce the two guests who will be with me. Barbara Morris is a practicing geriatrician, and she's one of the founding members of End of Life Options Colorado, which is really a cool group just started. She is a fierce advocate for patients and their families, especially regarding patient choice and self-determination. In 2019, she was faced with trying to help a patient with his end-of-life wishes while she was employed with a faith-based system that prohibited medical aid in dying. We're going to be talking about this a lot, the challenges, the opposition, the gains that we've made, but I will say, and I've said 1,000 times, she is my hero because this is the first time that anybody took on this national challenge of working with faith-based systems. And Ashley Fry is also going to join us. She's a palliative care nurse practitioner with 15 years of nursing experience. She holds board certification as an adult gerontology acute care nurse practitioner, and she's an advanced certified hospice and palliative nurse. So she has got her hands in many of these things that we have to be dealing with. She earned her doctor of nursing practice with a focus on health policy from George Washington University, and her doctoral project focus on the unique access challenges of medical aid in dying for rural Coloradans, also a really important topic we're going to need help with. So let me start out by giving you an overview of this, and then we're going to drill down into what's going on. Medical aid in dying, as you probably know, is a process of helping people who are already dying choose the time of their dying when they are done wanting to live. Important because this is not a medical procedure. This is about the wholeness of people's life, the holistic idea of what it means to them to want to live. So that's really important. We have this law now in Oregon and 10 states, Washington, D.C. being one of the jurisdictions. And every place that the law is passed, it has taken a lot of work. It is always vulnerable to being challenged or dismantled, so we want to be aware of that. It is a strenuous process. It is not easy to use medical aid in dying. There are technically usually 13 steps, lots of double checks. Barbara's going to talk more about that. And it is, like anything complicated, fraught with legal, political, and ethical issues. The biggest issues I think that we face are autonomy in a medical system and cultures that haven't really allowed us to do that. You will hear a lot about medical aid in dying called assisted suicide. It's not true. We can dismantle that one easily, but it is a playing card for the opposition. And we can talk more about that too. The second thing is our medical system has no training, and it isn't set up culturally or financially to support these processes. And the third thing is we still have gigantic chunks of ignorance and opposition politically, social concerns like the disability community and the faith-based communities were our two biggest opponents. The disability community is cracking as disabled people are saying, wait a minute, I want to use this. Double religious groups are doubling down, and we can talk about how what kind of influence they have. So what I will say in the larger picture, that fights have been going on over autonomy at any kind, any time in life, but particularly end-of-life care, since the 90s. This isn't new. It just happens to be the new edge right now. But in history, this is just the new critical edge. But right now, it is becoming more and more a battlefield for the individual right to live and die the way that you want to. You'll see as we talk that abortion rights are part of this fight. We are even looking at challenges to what death means and who controls your right to die with agency at all. So I want you to know all of what's important here, whether you ever intend to use this process or not. And I said, we need voices and we need help for both of the projects and organizations we're going to be talking with today. So I want to talk about Colorado. We have had our law for 6 years. Typical trajectory, first year, people were really freaked out, trying to find resources. By the second year, patients were going to their doctors saying, help me with this. And there was a little bit more education, a lot more resources. At this point, we have some really good health systems involved in Colorado, but there is still a grotesque level of ignorance. And some of the cases have turned out well and beautiful. And we still have some cases that are brutal. Education problems, gaps between the system, hospice, doctors. We're going to talk some about that today. Excuse me. So Colorado's law is what we call the first generation of laws. Barbara's going to describe what that process is about, what some of our gains have been, issues that are still here, and then Ashley's going to go into the second generation of law. So Barbara, can you talk about what the process is even about? What do you have to do? Barbara, we're having trouble picking you up. Can't hear you still. Okay, Ashley, would you start out with the first generation of law? And Barbara can pick it up because she's had a lot of experience working with it in Colorado.
Absolutely. So first generation law. When we think about our laws, a lot of them are modeled off of Oregon, who passed, they were the first one to enact a medical aid in dying law in 1997. So over the past 13, 14 years, laws modeled off that, they look similar. So two physicians have to participate in the process. One is an attending physician, one is a secondary physician that confirms the diagnosis and prognosis. Generally, two verbal requests have to be made 15 days apart to the attending physician, and then two witnesses also have to be involved in the process. So there has to be a written request that goes to the attending physician as well. And then finally, that has to be, you know, witnessed by two individuals. So that's sort of the first generation law, the basics of it. Mm-hmm. All the other laws followed after that one.
So Barbara, thanks. We got your voice now. Could you talk about breaking down with that process as you've been in attending, you've been in consulting, but what does it actually mean from what are the requirements?
Sure. Well, first, thank you so much. And thanks, Kim, for inviting me. It's an honor to be on this show with you and with Ashley as well. We really appreciate the opportunity to help explain a little bit more about medical aid in dying. Before I go to Kim's question, though, I always have to back up and make sure we remind listeners that medical aid in dying is a tool that we have. It's a powerful tool. It can help respect patients' wishes as they face terminal illness. But we always want everyone, families and patients, to understand that it's one tool in advanced care planning and in terminal care. And there are many ways to have the kind of death that you might want if you're facing terminal illness. And using medical aid in dying is one tool in that toolbox. And I just think it's important that we remember the big picture. So I have had the honor of helping patients as they face terminal illness, both with what we think of as more traditional hospice care, as well as making choices about medical aid in dying. And the law has been a powerful thing for us and for our patients as they make these extremely difficult choices. As Kim alluded to, what is causing the death is not medical aid in dying, but the illness. And that's something that is very important to remember. So it's the possible metastatic cancer or end-stage heart failure. So the first requirement for a patient to consider medical aid in dying in Colorado is that they are determined not only to have a terminal illness, but that terminal illness needs to have an expected prognosis of 6 months or less. That's part of our statute. And as the attending and consulting physician role to different people, we have to confirm that to our best medical knowledge, the patient has a terminal illness and a prognosis of less than 6 months. And that's a little bit the art of medicine and experience that helps us understand what a patient's prognosis might be. So that's the first requirement in terms of the statute. Then the other requirements are a part of what Ashley alluded to. Our statute is a little cumbersome. We have to have two what are called verbal requests, where the patient talks with the attending physician and makes the request for aid in dying separated by 15 days, as Ashley mentioned. We also have a written request in Colorado where a patient has to go through and say, I understand what medical aid in dying is. Nobody is coercing me into doing these things. And that form has to be witnessed. I should say it's also critical and part of the law that patients have decisional capacity. So what do we mean by that? That means that a patient has to be able to understand their illness, understand their prognosis, understand what their choice is, understand the implications of their choice, and also understand that they can change their mind at any point before they might take the medication, and that there's no evidence that they're being coerced into this decision. And those things are, I think, extremely important. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. when I interview a patient during their first and second request, we get very explicit about that question. And sometimes I say to the patient, this might sound odd to you, but I have to ask you, if you take these medications, what will happen? Because we have to be very clear that patients understand this is obviously a very important decision, and we want them to understand what's going on. And then another part of the requirements are that patients have to be able to self-administer the medication. Lots and lots of questions about this and lots of misinformation about self-administration. So what that means is that families or those helping at the bedside can assist with mixing medications, can assist with holding something like a cup, but the patient has to be able to ingest the medication themselves. So by sipping on a straw or sipping on the cup. There are other ways to self-administer medication that we can talk about later, but the idea is that the patient is in control of the situation. Mm-hmm. So I think I'll stop there. That's a lot. I don't know if we want to ask your questions now, Kim, or later, or if you have questions.
Yeah, I think I want to kind of cover our bases first, and then we'll open the phones. What Barbara said is critical because there are so many stop guards here. And so for the patient to even be eligible to talk, they have to be 18, they have to be a resident here, they do have to have capacity, as she said, and they do have to be able to self-administer. If those things are possible, then they start the qualification process, which Barbara described, which is talking to the docs, getting everything done. So there are two different steps here. And if you can't even become eligible, you can't start to qualify. So those are really important. And I'm just going to say before we turn this over too, we have learned so much. And I want to ask Barbara one more thing about this. The two things that I think will not change in this country in my lifetime are the self-administration piece, although in other parts of the world, that's not true. Doctors can help you with this. And there are places where, and the other piece is capacity. And you will see all along the healthcare system, there is nothing that we are dealing with medical aid and dying that is not true of geriatric care, that is not true of living situations for elders, that is not true of end-of-life care. The same issues are all over the place. And one of them is, how do we honor and take care of people who have dementia? So this idea, in some countries, they allow you to make advanced directives that say, when I get to the point where I cannot make my own decisions, I still want you to help me with medical aid in dying. Never going to probably happen here because of the way we're culturally set up, I think, at least in my time. And the same thing with self-administration, although we have made some big changes. So before we move on, I would love, Barbara, if you would talk about things like, how have we expanded this? What does ingestion look like? Because at the beginning, it was put it in my mouth, have capacity, and now we're able to help people with degenerative diseases, neurological diseases more. Can you talk about some of the updates?
Sure. I'd be happy to. And I want to clarify something I said, because there's so much information, as Kim says, that even those of us who do this every day forget things. And one is that in Colorado at the moment, and Ashley will talk about this, I think, later with efforts about fixing the law a little bit, is that in Colorado right now, it is required that both the attending role and the consulting role be physicians. Mm-hmm. And so I apologize if it came across as being physician-centric here, but our law right now is that way. It requires both of those roles being played by physicians. And the future may change that because we know that we don't have enough physicians who are able and willing to participate in the process. But for now, that's the way it is. And one of the barriers that you'll be thinking about is how do I find a physician if my physician is not able or willing? And we'll talk about that later as we get to our organizations and the kind of work we're doing. So to answer your question, Kim, about self-administration, that term is now expanded in an evidence-based way to include administration through a variety of ways. And I'll give a teaser and say that if you get queasy hearing about certain methods of administration, this is when you should go take a break. we're used to this in medicine, but not everybody is. So one method of administration is for those patients who have a tube placed in their stomach for a variety of reasons. Related to their underlying illness. And those patients are able to self-administer by using either a bag or a syringe that's attached to their tube. And they use a variety of methods, a valve or a syringe where they push, and that's self-administration. But it's not self-administration into the mouth. It's self-administration directly into the stomach. And that's become more and more common because it helps for patients who, for some reason, are not able to swallow. And then the other method of administration that we've been using more of recently, because it works very smoothly and very kindly for patients, even though this may sound strange to some of you, is rectal administration. The rectum has a lining that's actually in some ways similar to the stomach and the esophagus in that it can absorb medications quite well. And the medications work very effectively. This method requires that a catheter actually be placed in the rectum. And then a syringe is placed on the catheter with the medication. And the requirement, the self-administration definition, is that the patient be able to use their hand to push the plunger on the syringe to administer the medication through the rectum. So those are the methods we have right now in the U.S.
Can you explain why someone would need or use a rectal method rather than an oral method?
Yeah, that's it's actually a kind of a complicated question because, as with many things in medicine, it depends. But there are some patients where the gastrointestinal tract above, you know, of the level of the esophagus and the stomach and the first part of the small bowel may not be working. And if it's not working the way it's supposed to, which is to absorb things we put in there, then the medications won't be absorbed into the bloodstream and the medication won't work. And so these are patients who have obstruction somewhere along that part of the gastrointestinal tract. And so that's why they might not be able to use that method. There are some patients who use rectal administration because they're really having a lot of trouble swallowing. Mm-hmm. Their stomach might be working, but they can't be swallowing and they don't have a permanent tube in place already, you know, for some other reason. And so we have found, I know this may sound strange to non-medical people, so if you're just joining us back from a break, but it is a method that does go very smoothly for most patients. It requires a little bit more medical support at the time, at the bedside, because of the need to place the small catheter in the rectum. But it can go very smoothly.
Perfect. Ashley, did you have something you wanted to add?
I just wanted to add, when we talk about patients with disabilities and we talk about self-administration, there's a concern that those with progressive neurological illness may not be able to use their hands in order to self-administer. And so there are creative ways to help patients who have progressive neurological illness, for example, using eye movement technology to, you know, to set up, like what Barbara was saying, in terms of with a syringe or a feeding tube to help self-administer. So they're still in control, and it still empowers them to be in control of that situation, even if they've lost mobility in their hands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll say one thing that I was going to say later, and then I want to ask Barbara about the formula. In California, a lawsuit was actually filed last year basically saying, according to the American Disabilities Act, you're asking people who require help for every one of their ADLs, everything they do, to they need help for everything else, but they can't get help for medical aid in dying if they can't use their hands. And the court basically said no. But that's the kind of challenges that we're really looking for. How can we say this person needs help, but we won't help them with one thing in their life? So we've got these kind of complications going on. So I have one more question, Barb, because we get this a lot. What exactly are they taking? Can you, does it have street value? How do we stop a body? You know, because
well,
it scares people.
You know, I'm actually not, I won't go through all the medications and the dosages because I don't think that would be helpful. Mm-hmm. But let's just say that the formula is a combination of very potent medications. Morphine is one of them. Valium, many of you would know the name of, is one of them. Digoxin is another one. Amitriptyline and phenobarbital. And these are medications that affect our physiology in different ways. And those folks who've been involved with the science of medical aid in dying for way longer than I have spent a tremendous amount of time actually doing the research on which of these medications are the most effective and which formulas work the best. And recently we feel we've come to a formula that is very effective for the vast majority of patients because these medications affect different parts of our body. So they affect our basically our heart and our breathing, and ultimately, of course, our brain if our heart stops and our breathing stops. And so we currently, I think, nationally have an evidence base that's very powerful in helping clinicians know what the most up-to-date information is. And part of the role of our new organizations, and particularly in Colorado, is to make sure that clinicians have the support and mentoring they need to be using the most recent formula. So street value. These drugs are lethal. Let's be clear. These drugs cause death if taken in the doses we use. And so we are extremely cautious about prescriptions and dispensing of medications. And we can talk more about that, Kim, if you want.
Okay, well, let me just say, historically, when medical aid in dying, quote, first happened, there was one drug that we used, Secanol. It was very expensive. And at some point, a company in Canada bought it, made it more expensive, really out of our out of the league, but also they had some personal religious ideas about whether or not they wanted to make it available. And at that time, you had to uncap 99 capsules to get the amount together. So some people made it into a ritual, you know, as they were saying goodbye. As we've, and one of the things that happened there is there wasn't much variation in bodies. So if you were a long distance runner and your heart was a little stronger than usual, it might be harder to stop. So the formulas that Barbara's talking about have created a very sophisticated experience that helps most people die easily. And so the one last thing I want to ask you about this, Barbara, is what does a medical aid in dying death look like? Because at the beginning, if people died in 6 hours, as most hospice patients, they don't die on time. People would get freaked out. So generally speaking, could you talk about what the death looks like? Because I think that's made people, understanding that has made people a lot more comfortable with why this is important.
Sure, thanks. And I've had the honor of being attending medical aid in dying deaths. And so, you know, as with anything in health and medicine and dying, things are variable. But at the present time, what we're seeing for the vast majority of medical aid in dying patients is that the patients take the medication and they fall deeply, deeply asleep, usually within 5 minutes. With rectal administration, we're seeing patients fall asleep, deeply asleep, within about 2 minutes. And at that point, the patient is deeply asleep, really unaware of any further suffering. On average, then, with all of these methods of administration, patients are, the vast majority, again, are dying very peacefully within about 2 hours. And for those patients that I have been able to be at the bedside, I would just personally report to you that it is a very beautiful and very peaceful thing, as patients are reasonably very comfortable, actually, and families are able to be there to the extent that they would like to be. Now, not to say there are rare circumstances that we can't always predict where the death is more prolonged. And in that case, it can go for many hours, on very, very, very rare occasion, up to you know, 12 or 16 hours, but we're seeing very, very few of those in with the current formulas. I would just say that one of the things we coach our newer clinicians and our families about is understanding what we usually see, but preparing everyone that it could take longer. Because in my experience, it's all about expectations. Mm-hmm. So when things go very quickly and smoothly, it's wonderful. And if it goes a little longer, then at least we are all prepared for that.
Great. This is Top of the Hour. I want to remind us that we are listening to KGNU FM 88.5 Boulder, 1390 Denver. I also want to say this show has been going on for 10 years. We are the only community radio that we know of across the country that has said death and dying is an important enough topic that we're going to lock it into our regular programming. So we are way cool over here at KGNU. I'm going to remind you to support them any way you can. Skip that latte. Give them a little bit more money. Show up at the events. Help us keep this front and center because we have gotten such good feedback and help so many people. I want to say one more thing, and then I really want to turn this over to Ashley, and that, as Barb is describing the experience, we still deal with people who want to call this suicide. Excuse me. There is a big difference, many differences between suicide and medical aid in dying. The short version is basically people who are using medical aid in dying are dying. There's nothing they can do about this. People who are using suicide as a way to end their lives often are not dying. They just don't want to be here. And the experiences that we see at the bedside, there is no trauma. People have a chance to say goodbye. Many of the hallmarks of suicide that are horrible are not part of the medical aid in dying experience. And that is a whole show unto itself. Okay, so that's where we are in Colorado and nationally. There's some lawsuits I want to tell you about, but Ashley is going to go into the second generation. We are part of that, but would you explain not only what that means, but what you are doing about it? Because this is a big action item today, folks.
Sure. So second generation laws. Really, we start seeing this in 2021. New Mexico passed the Elizabeth Whitefield End of Life Options Act, and it's quite unique and different than prior first generation medical aid in dying laws. So in New Mexico, a physician can act as the attending or the secondary provider, but it also allows for nurse practitioners or physician's assistants to be a primary prescribing or attending provider as well. So we are allowing nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, and physicians to work together to meet patient needs. Other unique things about New Mexico, they've reduced their waiting period down to 48 hours. So here in Colorado, we need those two verbal requests and they are separated by 15 days. In New Mexico, patients can obtain their medical aid in dying medications in as little as 48 hours. And then another unique thing about New Mexico is that if a patient is enrolled in hospice, it has already been determined that they have a prognosis of 6 months or less. So at that point, only one physician needs to certify the terminal illness and prognosis prior to prescribing medical aid in dying medications. So really unique and different compared to what we've seen prior to 2021. What we've seen in the past couple of years then is that states that already have medical aid in dying laws, states like Oregon, Washington State, Hawaii, California, have been looking at that New Mexico law and proposing amendments and passing new laws to improve their medical aid in dying laws. So an example being Hawaii and Washington State this year have amended their laws, improved them so that advanced practice providers or physician's assistants can partner with physicians in these states to help meet patient needs. We're reducing waiting times. Even in other laws that are being proposed across the country, new laws in states like Virginia and Indiana, laws were proposed this year that would have automatically allowed advanced practice registered nurses or nurse practitioners to participate in the process. So when we're talking about second generation laws, we're talking about these more progressive changes that make it easier for patients to access medical aid in dying while also keeping safeguards in place. Mm-hmm.
And of course, the opposition is saying you are removing those safeguards. A lawsuit in California that's been problematic is, believe it or not, the Christian Doctors and Dentists Association, pretty much saying, nope, we can't remove any more safeguards. And I'll tell you more about that particular lawsuit later. But in Colorado, Ashley, those are particularly important. And I'm going to mess this up because we have three different kinds of counties, don't we? We have the populated counties, we have the rural, and then what is the name for the Twilight Zone?
Frontier counties. So rural counties have a definition of having less than 50,000 residents in their city center. Frontier counties, which we really see out east and down south in the state of Colorado, they have less than 6 residents per square mile. So they're pretty isolated out there. Almost 80% of our landmass here in Colorado is rural and frontier. So a lot of times laws are built around the needs of urban residents. And if you look at the state of Colorado, really our urban center is just right smack dab in the middle of the state, right along that spine, along the Front Range. And so these patients in rural and frontier communities, they have very different health services available to them. So an example being nurse practitioners and physician's assistants and clinical nurse specialists, we are serving as the primary care providers in these communities. We outnumber physicians 3-2. And there are certain counties here in Colorado, especially again down east and down south in these frontier counties, where there is no physician available within the county. And so I'll often hear people say, well, we have access to telemedicine now, which is true. That's great. But internet access can also be very limited in these rural communities. Broadband access is limited. Satellite internet access is not necessarily good. Cellular service can be limited as well. Mental health services are also limited in these communities. So like Barbara said, if there's a decision of medical decision-making capacity, does this patient understand their choice? Can they make this decision? Per the Colorado law, only a psychiatrist or a psychologist is allowed to perform that capacity assessment formally. That's different than like New Mexico, which we talked about, which is progressive, which allows psychiatric nurse practitioners to participate and social workers to do capacity assessments. Even as a nurse practitioner here in Colorado, I do capacity assessments regularly on patients. So that's something to keep in mind, that those mental health resources are very limited in rural communities. And finally, pharmacy access can be limited. So about 20% of rural and frontier counties do not have a pharmacy whatsoever. And then 23% only have one pharmacy. Mm-hmm. So per the law, any of us, any healthcare provider can say, I'm not comfortable participating in this process. I'm choosing to conscientiously object. And so what does a patient do in a rural remote area if their one pharmacist says, I'm not participating in this? If they don't have a doctor that can participate in this, it brings about the concern for just and equitable health care for rural Coloradans.
Mm-hmm. We're not going to have a lot of time to talk about this, but what's really critical, too, is that hospices play a unique and handicapped part of this process. 95% of people who use medical aid in dying are enrolled in hospices. And while hospice in Colorado, the docs do not prescribe. So it puts the families in an unusual position. And hospices are also unevenly educated about how they can support the families. But the hospices that, they're critical parts. So when the opposition says, well, patients need to be presented with other options and hospice is another option, they're not. They're part of this continuum. They are part of this. It's not one or the other. Most patients are in hospice, but what she's talking about is also true of hospices. In those rural and frontier communities, there may be one hospice that's serving 1,400 square miles. So they are not able to be good allies in this process either.
Yeah. No, you're correct. And I've even heard, not only have I heard people say hospice shouldn't be involved, which is incorrect, but I've also heard folks say palliative care shouldn't be involved in this process as a conflict of interest, which I thoroughly disagree with. We are all about improving quality of life and symptom burden, and talking about options like medical aid in dying help reduce anxiety. And so absolutely, palliative practitioners should be involved in this process, as should hospice.
Mm-hmm. And again, anything more upstream is really important. Some of the stronger opposition I've run into is people saying palliative care can handle all this. Palliative care can handle pain management. Number one, nothing can 100%. But most of the people who are choosing this nationally are not doing it necessarily because of medical pain, because of physical pain. And because they're in hospice, they are in palliative care, which is one of the reasons we think that quality of life is what comes up most often, is why people are doing this. Again, that wholeness. I am not me living the life that I want. Pain management comes in, I think, third or fourth, because mm-hmm. they are receiving palliative care already. So mm-hmm. a lot of what we see oppositionally is because people are choosing chunks of things that they don't understand the whole picture. Okay, so here we are. We are looking at the rest of the country. Some of the changes that have been made, all of them are being made for the sake of the patient and the families, because this is a unit of care. Oppositionally, and you can tell I'm way in this court, oppositionally, one of the things that we have to watch is that every time a law is amended, it is challenged again by the opposition. It's sort of like they wait for that moment that it gets back into legislation. And one of the issues in Colorado is that we are a frontier state. There are lots of things here that aren't regulated, and we don't want to be regulated. And one of the things that's not regulated very well is that every coroner's office can make a lot of decisions on their own. So lots of variations between the counties. And what I've heard from some coroners, and this is true in other states, when you use medical aid in dying, as Barbara alluded to early, the cause of death on the death certificate does not say suicide. It describes the underlying disease. It's not the method. It's what did they actually die of? They died of their disease. We have coroners who want to make sure in their minds that suicide is put on that death certificate. And so every time any law is challenged in any state, we have people or situations like that where they're looking to particularly reduce this to and take it back into a suicide definition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we saw that out east. There were a couple laws introduced this year so that the death certificate would say suicide instead of the underlying disease process. Those laws did not go anywhere.
So could you describe, this is a very complicated situation, but could you describe what we're going to do about that this year? What are you doing? Because you are the linchpin for changing our law, hopefully.
Thank you so much. So we are working together to build a coalition of citizens to engage with their elected officials to try to get a law introduced to amend the Colorado End of Life Options Act. That's the name of our law that's been in effect since December 2016. And so just a little bit of the background work I did. I, in part of my doctoral project, did a health policy analysis, really looking at the rural healthcare access needs for medical aid in dying. And then from that, took that information and led an advocacy campaign to start educating legislators about the challenges with access. And the laws that have come about since our law went into effect in 2017 and proposed recommendations to amend our law. And so last legislative session that just ended about a month ago, I was able to reach out to about 50 legislators and provide this information to them. In general, received really favorable feedback on this, just being mindful that 2024 is an election year. So that can certainly play a part in what legislators may choose to put forth next year as legislation. Mm-hmm. So some things we need to do. Continuing to educate clinicians about the need for policymaker engagement. We need to continue talking to clinicians about what medical aid in dying is. Where I'm at in Southern Colorado, it's a heavy military town. We get a lot of nurses and physicians that come in from all other parts of the country. And it is not uncommon for me to hear healthcare clinicians telling patients medical aid in dying is illegal. Do not ask about that. We're calling for a psych consult. So we need to continue to educate clinicians about medical aid in dying, that it's legal here in the process to go about it. Also working to obtain support and resources from local and national organizations to help lead this effort. even if someone can't or an agency can't help contribute financially, just being able to reach out to your supporters and say, hey, medical aid and dying, we want to try to amend this law and make it better. If you're interested, here's how we would go about doing it. We're also building a formal coalition of experts to work together to then go out and encourage citizens to talk to their legislators. The most common thing I heard from legislators was, I support this, but I need to hear from my own constituents. I live in a different part of the state. They need to hear from folks that live in their part of the state that they support this. Mm-hmm. And so those are the sort of things that we're working towards this summer. You know, please know that even though the session just ended about a month ago, legislators are actively right now looking at what they're going to introduce for the 2024 legislative session. They have to introduce their bills starting in November, December. And so now this summer, starting in July, August, it's the time to be talking with legislators about this and seeing who could potentially sponsor a bill.
Mm-hmm. Cool. We are taking calls. If you have a question, if you have a comment, please feel free to get a hold of us. Okay, so we've got that going on.
The number is 303-442-4242 if you'd like to call in with a question. Again, that number is 303-442-4242.
Thank you, Shannon. That makes it so much easier. there are two other things I want to mention really quickly. One particularly, and then I want to ask Barbara and Ashley if they have anything else. We'll probably stop and do closing comments at about 25 after. And that is bringing up again hospice, because as I said, we want patients in hospice. Although this is a unique procedure, everybody is going through end-of-life issues. What hospice does and does well, oftentimes, is make sure that the family is on board. Make sure that the family is not only on board with the process, but that they understand what's going on. They understand the dynamics of anybody who's leaving this life, starting with the fact that we, and Barbara alluded to this, there are very few physicians who understand medical aid in dying. There's a larger, but not that big, group of doctors who even understand end-of-life care, who know what it means to pull the plug on all the meds that aren't helping anymore. And hospice faces unique challenges, like you take away meds that aren't helping and the patient appears to look better because they're actually doing things that are appropriate to that point in life. So that holistic piece, again, how you help a patient get ready for end-of-life. And one of the things about it, medical pictures of the family on them. And as the person ingested his medication, they all toasted with him with their matching cups. There is, just as with all of end of life, there is a lot of humor around this and goodwill. So people have found a way, oftentimes with the help of the hospice staff, to really create time and space to say goodbye and appropriate ways to leave legacies. And sometimes, I swear to God, people are just so funny. And one of the best things I've ever heard is a man who, it doesn't taste good. The medication doesn't taste good. And there was a man who looked at it, tasted it, and said, this is really bad, but I'm going to drink it if it kills me. It also helps them feel more confident because this is a big deal. The grief process around this is in some ways much less complicated and in some ways very unique when you are assisting someone in ending their life. People have said, oh my God, Tuesday at 10 o'clock, that totally freaked me out to tick down the minutes until he died. Other people have said, this is really incredibly helpful to be able to make a choice like that. So one of the funny stories was a woman who was practicing with a popsicle, because we encourage people to have sorbet or something cold afterward, and she was reading the calories on the popsicle as though it still mattered the day before she died. So we do live until we die. Really important to understand. So last-minute things that I haven't touched on, Barbara, Ashley, anything that you really think it's important that people understand? Ashley?
Kim, you touched on this in terms of hospice, but also considering policies of other organizations. We know that hospital systems now own a lot of the outpatient clinics, and so policies within a healthcare organization can trickle down, will trickle down into those outpatient clinics. Mm-hmm. So being mindful, if you or a family member is interested in medical aid in dying, getting on websites, learning what the policy is for a healthcare organization, not just health organizations, but also things like in assisted living facilities or nursing homes, what their policy is on that, and hospice agencies as well. Being mindful that even if you go to a clinic where the organization policy supports medical aid in dying or is neutral about medical aid in dying, that you may encounter a physician that isn't supportive of it. They may conscientiously object. And so as an example, I've had three cases presented to me in about the last 6 weeks to participate in this process, but the physician isn't comfortable with it. And they say, no, I'm sorry, I won't do it. And I don't know anybody that will. And that shuts a door. Mm-hmm. It's unfortunate. And so having other resources, being mindful of other resources like End of Life Options Colorado, which we should talk about, but who can you reach out to for help if your physician or agency says, I'm sorry, we're not going to participate in this. Mm-hmm. Those are just things to be mindful of.
Yeah. And I will say one thing, and I really want Barbara to talk about this organization because we have not had one. All the other states, almost all of them, had an organization that started when the law was passed. And we have been unique in that. But one of the other things was going through the efficiently going through, you know, all the criteria and the process. But it still is different than having someone who's known you for a very long time really support you through it. We have a couple mm-hmm. different health systems in Colorado, Kaiser, Denver Health, Boulder Community Health, that actually have systems in place so that when you come in, you get the support of the physicians. They work the process with you. They have access to pharmacy. That's what we would like. It's the reason we have to become more seamless working with hospice, support them, coming from a doctor to a healthcare system to an assisted living. We're not even going to get into the issues that happen when somebody lives in an unfriendly place. So we've got a couple more minutes. Barbara, could you talk about what the state organization is going to do?
Yeah, thanks to both of you for the segue. So End of Life Options Colorado, Kim also being a founding member of our organization, we incorporated in late fall and we've been busy working on what we're going to do. You can look us up at endoflifeoptionscolorado.org. I think that what I want to say is someone in healthcare who's looking for help. And our goal is very simple, but challenging. Our goal is to make sure that all Coloradans have information about medical aid in dying and end-of-life choices, and also have access to those services should they decide that's what they want. And a big piece of that is what we've touched on already, is we want to make sure Coloradans have good information, and we want to make sure that your care teams have good information. And if they are not able to help you, for whatever reasons, the kinds of things that Ashley talked about, the challenges we have with the faith-based systems, which could be a whole nother radio show, we want clinicians to know who they can talk to get help. And that help could be care teams and patients who are in these restrictive settings. Hospice is not restrictive in that sense, but it can create some challenges, as Kim has talked about. And so we're here to work on those issues and to make sure that we're collaborating with the important goal that all of you as Coloradans can express your rights and can have the kind of deaths that you want in the event that you're facing terminal illness with very limited prognosis.
Yes, and End of Life Options Colorado will also be doing a lot of general education for people who are not actively involved in the process. We want people with all end of life care to really understand it upstream. So, you know, community groups, anybody who wants to hear about it, it's important that we do that because who knows who's going to end up later needing it or who can talk to their doctor or their clergy people. So there will be a lot of general education also. And I will again say that we have some real success stories, but between particularly the gaps, we have some really horrible stories that have happened in Colorado. And even within hospice, one team might be really good and another team might think it's illegal. So the level of education here is critical. This should be, as hospice, what we hope for is a seamless process of support with education all along the way and us working heartily to take the places that are really problematic and either turn them around or help them understand how to gracefully move people into good support. So right now this is very choppy and we're spending a lot of time trying to do broad education. The education, the resistance is one thing, but I think Barbara and I and Ashley would agree, the education has got to be a lot broader. So if you're interested in helping with that, End of Life Options is also looking for volunteers. You can get on the website and talk to them about what they might be able to do, what they're doing. And right now it's a lot of education about who they are and trying to get the word out about who they are. We have national supports. We have the American Clinicians Academy for Medical Aid in Dying, which is a national organization for clinicians. We have Death with Dignity and Compassion and Choices that are two of the largest advocacy groups that do a lot of trying to get the laws passed. I also want to say, before we're done, this group, this show, as I said, has been going on 10 years. We can talk about whatever you want. We have talked about the top five regrets of people dying. We've talked about spiritual traditions. We won the first place in, Shannon, the PRNDI award for one of our shows, What Happens to Bodies After Death. First year we were here, we won a golden reel for a five-part series on hospice death. We've talked about GLBT loss, child loss, veterans at end of life, how to take people off life support, hope, what it's like in the ambulance and the ER. What do you want to hear about? Because we can talk about anything. And it also helps us understand how big death is. It's personal to one of you, but it's also a global experience that we really should know a lot about. And quite frankly, if we're not talking about you particularly, it's fascinating. It's when we turn around and say, Shannon, what do you want? That people run for the bathroom and never come back. So we have 2 minutes left. I would like to remind you that my website, if you want to hear more about these things, and if you want to get involved in any of these projects, you can also get a hold of me at practically-dying.com. Get on there and also let me know if there's anything in particular that you want to cover. Barbara and Ashley, would you again tell people how to get a hold of you?
Thanks. Endoflifeoptionscolorado.org. We have a contact form and we will be in touch with you promptly if you need to talk with us.
Okay. And Ashley?
Yes. If you are interested in reaching out to your legislator and what helps with that process, please don't hesitate to reach out to me. My email address is ashleyfrynp@gmail.com.
Okay.
And it's ashleyfrynp@gmail.com.
And I think we can put those afterward, can we put those on the website so that it's easy to get contact information? We have 35 seconds. I'm really grateful that you are on the show. I hope everybody at home is going, yes, damn it, they're not going to. I want you to be rabid about this particular thing because this is going to make a difference in how we treat all of our end-of-life choices, all of our beginning-of-life choices, how they define death. We are really in an action mode right now, and we are blessed to have so many smart people like Barbara and Ashley, working on this. So thank you. Thank you for listening. Tell us what else you want to hear about and take good care of yourselves.